yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show, Alternative Visions. Today we're going to talk about an extremely important issue. We're going to talk about the EPA, Environment Protection Agency, and President Obama's newly issued rules. Well, actually, the detail of the rules aren't really fully developed, but requiring industrial plants in the U.S. to reduce CO2, carbon dioxide, emissions. Why is this important? Well, because it's becoming absolutely obvious that we have a real global warming problem, and this global warming problem is going to have immense economic impacts. Already it has begun to do so, not only in the U.S., but globally, but here in the U.S. as well. You know, one of the problems with environmental issues is that people can't see them as clearly. People react politically to things they can see, feel, touch, and so forth, but this is kind of a ominous threat because it's hard to see it, except, of course, when you have severe global warming, which is happening, and it starts impacting your environment. But even then, the connections are not often very clear. But this is an extremely important problem because in a couple decades, the economic impact will be immense. The costs of this problem will be immense. And we already have a capitalist economy here in the U.S. and globally, that's very clearly, since the turn of the century, slowing in terms of investment, real investment, creating real jobs that pay real income that people can use to sustain their standard of living, is declining. Investment is declining. Well, we've talked about that a lot. Why is it declining? Well, the rich are getting richer, and corporations are becoming even more wealthy, and their bankers are becoming even greater profits. But it's not being redirected into the real economy for real folks. It's being used to speculate in financial assets around the globe. Okay, we've been talking about that previous shows about China, what's going on there, emerging markets, Eurozone, and the United States. So capitalism has a real problem in the 21st century. But here comes the real problem, and that's the environment. It's going to take immense investments in order to deal with this environmental problem in clean energy and reducing emissions and so forth. But capitalism can't even generate investments now. What's going to be the crisis, and when will it come? Okay, so that's the Achilles heel of the capitalist system. Long run, can it deal with this environmental crisis? And I'm not too optimistic about that. But by 2030, we will see whether it can or it can't. And by 2030, we'll either be too late, and we'll be on a road to terrible environmental crises, or perhaps with a little luck, we'll be able to adjust it and deal with it. Now, that's going to take people power because corporations and their friends are in politics are not going to do it. Anyway, that's the context that we're talking about. And we want to talk about the proposed Obama EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, rules that came out earlier this week. And are these for real? And I have a guest today who's really well qualified to discuss this. It's Stephen Brayman, who is the EPA administrator for the Green Shadow Cabinet. We are colleagues on the Green Shadow Cabinet I'm the shadow Federal Reserve Chairman, and he is the EPA Administrator. Okay, and he's well qualified. You know, he's worked in climate change policy in New York State, was a bureaucrat for the U.S. State Department, and he currently teaches peace, environmental, and media studies at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. I hope I pronounced that right. Stephen, glad to have you on.
Jack, glad to be here. Yeah, it's Rensselaer, but almost
Rensselaer. Okay.
So you're not alone.
Okay, right. Well, we West Coasters don't, you know, on these strange cities you got back there, hard to pronounce some of them.
Well, as New Yorkers know, we were formerly New Netherlands before we were New York, and so
right. There
are still Dutch names.
So that's a Dutch word, Rensselaer, okay.
Van Rensselaer was a feudal overlord for a huge amount of upstate New York. He was called the Patroon and has left us, he and his descendants, certain useful institutions, including the place I teach, RPI.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, let's get on to this emissions issue here. Just for the audience, a little preview of what we're talking about, then you can jump in and give us more detail about the rules. Basically, and correct me if I'm wrong in your comments, these new EPA rules require a 30% reduction in CO2 emissions by 2030, based on a benchmark of 2005. So we got 25 years.
Well, Jack, interrupt you real quickly because this is one of the limitations of the proposal. It applies only to power plants.
Only to power plants.
So not your automobile, not your home, not your office, not your factory, merely to electricity-generating power stations.
But aren't they the biggest polluters, CO2 polluters in the country? Like one-third, I understand, one-third of all the CO2 pollution comes from these power plants?
They are a major component of carbon and other pollution, Jack. Whether you want to call them the number one is kind of controversial. Depends on how you count and the like.
I see. And it's not
around one-third is correct, where transportation is about another third, and then what you'd call buildings and all of that means are about the other third.
Right, and these plants not only emit CO2, but all these other dangerous chemicals like arsenic and mercury and so on and so forth. These are real dirty fellows, these industrial plants.
Well, those are the fossil fuel type, right? You can't say the same thing about a solar electricity generating station or a wind farm, for example, which emit none of those bad things. And then in the fossil fuel list, coal's the worst, oil's the second worst, and then natural gas the least bad when it comes both to carbon and other emissions.
Including methane, right? There's all this
stuff,
right?
Methane is essentially another term for natural gas. It's an issue, and we should talk about it, but if the plant is efficient, the natural gas-fired power plant is efficient, it ought not to be leaking methane.
Okay.
To be burning it. Let me say a little about Jack, give you some details. The draft proposal announced recently by the EPA and signed off on by, of course, the White House is just the beginning of the process. Okay, it is a draft set of rules. Rules are a technical term for the means by which federal regulatory agencies go about their business. The EPA will now take public comment for some period of time. I haven't seen the precise period. It's usually a reasonable amount of time, 3 months, sometimes 6 months. That gives us a chance to weigh in on it, but it also gives industry and other opponents of attempts to reduce carbon emissions a chance to weigh in on it. It will then spend the next year following the closure of public comments completing the proposal before releasing a final rule a year from now. So we will not see the actual final rule until June 2015. And then after that, states, right, all 50 United States are going to have to implement this rule. They'll be given another year to submit compliance plans, which are just what they sound like. Here's how New York or California or Arizona or Wyoming intends to comply with this EPA rule. So they get a whole year to do that, or even more, because they can apply for an extension, and it's fair to anticipate now that there'll be some of those extension applications. Something else to say about it immediately, Jack, is that it is not an executive order. Instead, it's a rule, which is a technical term, that in this case, the EPA is issuing under its authority granted to it by the Clean Air Act. The Clean Air Act requires the EPA to regulate any substance defined as a pollutant. Okay, and a pollutant is a substance that endangers human life and health. There was, I'm sure many listeners will recall, an important Supreme Court decision in 2007 that permitted, encouraged even, the EPA to begin to treat carbon dioxide as a pollutant, which it had not done to that point, and it's taken 7 years from 2007 for EPA finally to get around to writing rules that will reduce carbon emissions from at least power plants.
Well,
what else can I tell you?
It sounds to me that this whole process is such that we're just going to hear a lot of talk until the 2016 elections.
That's right. There will be no actual change in the fuel mix by which this country generates its electricity due to this rule prior to that point. And you can also, I think, be pretty confident, Jack, that the fossil fuel electricity sector, especially those utilities heavily reliant on coal, will sue, most likely not successfully because of this previous Supreme Court decision, but nonetheless will find it in their interest to sue on some technical grounds to slow this already drawn-out process even further.
Well, that's all very interesting. Yes, big delays, in other words, and as the delays occur, that means that this 30% will have to be achieved in a shorter time period. By the way, on that 30%, correct me if I'm wrong here, that 16%, from what I've read, have of those objectives, rules, targets, have already been achieved. So we're really talking about only another 14% reduction in the next 15 years. Is that correct?
That is an average across the whole country, Jack. So on the one hand, it's correct. But if you look at individual states, some, of course, since we're talking about an average, have made even deeper carbon emissions reductions in recent years. And we're talking about from 2005 levels, by the way. There's another sort of cooking the books by the Obama administration that we could come back and talk about later if you'd like to. But then there are other states, especially those highly dependent on coal for the generation of electricity, and those include, you know, notorious number one and number two coal producing states, Wyoming and West Virginia, that have a lot further to go.
And listeners should be aware, too, that this 30% is like an average for the next 15 years across the states, that it's really the states that are going to have to do this reduction. It's not the federal government. And the differences in terms of what states have to reduce how much is really pretty immense. Like, I understand Washington State, the target for their share of this target of 30%, they have to reduce by 72%, whereas real emissions creating states like North Dakota only have to reduce 11%. So it's not even an even burden, is it, across the states? Is that going to be a legal issue?
Well, again, there will, if you happen to be a betting man, Jack, or any of your listeners tend toward gambling, it's a safe bet to say there will be multiple suits, including from state affiliates of the EPA. Let me back up and say you had mentioned that this in the end gets implemented by the states and not by the feds. That's the case with almost all, I should say, environmental regulation. Every state has some analog of the EPA. The name varies from state to state, and it's those state analogs that are required to follow EPA guidelines, rules, and regulations, and impose them upon, whether it be in this case power plants or drivers or any other actor within their state. So, you know, this is federalism in action. We could talk about the costs and benefits of it. But indeed, the rollout's going to be uneven. It's going to be halted by litigation of various sorts from various actors across this public comment period, and then across the compliance rule writing period. It would not be unusual were it not the final rule not ready to go by 2015, and that the state's not ready to go by 2016 or 2017. I'd be surprised were all those ducks in a row by then.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's say. Let's take a couple of scenarios. Let's say that Obama loses the Senate in 2014 here. In other words, the Republicans get a majority. We know the Republicans are rabidly opposed to this. Most of them probably don't even believe there is such a thing as global warming in Congress, at least in the House. We got some real ignorance going on there in the House of Representatives. But let's say they lose the Senate as well. What's to stop Congress from passing a law next year or in 2016 to pretty much negate this EPA effort?
The only thing that would stop them would be a presidential veto, and if they were able, which they're unlikely, even if they take the Senate, to generate a two-thirds vote in both houses to overturn that presidential veto, then indeed all of this could be off the table. But I suspect even if they take the Senate, it's going to be by a couple of seats, will not constitute a two-thirds majority. And so at least while Obama's in office, he'll be able to stop any attempted rollback.
Okay, but after 2016, that may not be the case, and it doesn't sound to me like any of this has any chance of being implemented until 2016 or after.
Or after, that's right. And you know, I don't want to say all bets are off as a consequence. I mean, we could, you know, I don't know if you want to go down the road of predicting who's going to win a presidential election a couple of years from now, but, you know, it's really important to note that this is not... of course, right, coming from the Obama administration, this is not either adequate response to climate change as a whole, nor is it economically costly. The cost benefit analysis that the EPA did has, of course, admits that there are going to be some upfront costs in the shift of fuels and the closing down of coal-fired plants. It's going to be essentially impossible, unless one believes in the fantasy of carbon sequestration and storage, a couple of pilot programs on coal plants as we speak, and yet they're not working out, very serious technical and economic difficulties. So it's pretty fair to say, Jack, down the road, we won't see any new coal plants, but there'll be retooling necessary to move to these other fuels and move to renewables. But those costs, estimated at somewhere between $7 and $8 billion annually once the rule is implemented, are totally outweighed to various sorts of health benefits regarding mitigating respiratory diseases and preventing premature deaths that the EPA estimates range from 50-some billion to 90-some billion, right? So the economics, both in sheer dollar terms and then also in human health and ecosystem health terms, completely are in favor of this proposal. This is fair to say. But again, it's also fair to say, I can back up and ask, answer the question, is this better than nothing? And your answer to that sort of depends on how you view things. On the simplest, most basic level, yes, this is better than nothing. But if you want to look at it in terms of opportunity costs, if you want to ask, well, if indeed we agree this doesn't go far enough, can we see this as merely a first step to further action, or do we see this as a step that then has national legislators say things like, hey, we've done that, right? We're not going to take any more steps. That's as far as we can go. In that sense, you could say this is the EPA's plan is worse than nothing.
Well, some say, some critics say that this is a move by Obama to resurrect his cap and trade program by pretty much leaving it up to the states and therefore giving an impetus to the states to expand their cap and trade. For listeners, cap and trade is simply where the government issues credits, carbon credits. And then those carbon credits can be traded like a financial security on a marketplace for industries, companies to offset the cost of their reduction of, you know, the investment in the reduction. Europe has a cap and trade. We've had a kind of cap and trade with some sulfur and so forth emissions going on.
Also here in the Northeast, Jack, we've got the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGI, which is a cap and trade program for carbon emissions from fossil fuel powered electricity generators. So you know, back to the question, is it better than nothing? Yes. Is it the answer? Is it what we need? Is it sufficient to address the problem? Is it superior to a carbon tax or just flat ceilings that generators have to meet and don't get to come up with tradable discharge permits? And it's a no to all those other questions. This is simply too little, too late.
But will it stimulate state cap-and-trade programs? And the question is, does cap-and-trade really reduce CO2 emissions? Well, it really hasn't in Europe, where it's been deployed. But it sounds to me like, Obama came into office with a cap-and-trade proposal, then abandoned it in 2010. And here we are 6 years into his regime, and it looks like he's trying to resurrect that at the state level. As you say, there is a cap and trade thing operating in Massachusetts and in the Northeast, trying to expand it. And there's one in California recently.
Yes.
This is an attempt to get the states to do what he can't do at the national level. And then the bigger question is, will it actually reduce anything?
What's your opinion on that? It does reduce emissions, Jack. Here it's used to be 11 states. New Jersey recently dropped out. 10 left in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative here in the Northeast. It does reduce carbon emissions and other air pollution from power plants. But again, it's a very limited sector of the economy. The reductions are, in my view, as a matter of fact, I was working for the state of New York, the climate change office, as REGI was being put in place. I strongly argued that it was, you know, inadequate, that the ceilings for emissions were set too high, the drawdown was set too low, the permits were too cheap. In other words, a kind of standard critique of a market response to a pollution problem, and yet the response was inevitably, this is the best we can do, this is the most that politics will allow, we'll come back later and have another bite at the apple, which the state hasn't, by the way. It set some targets that are that are nice and yet doesn't have policies in place to meet those targets. You're right to see it as a way around Congress, that Congress shot down Obama's cap and trade plan, which again was inadequate. It's not the best way to do this. Economists are of nearly one voice in singing the merits of a carbon tax versus a cap and trade program. But then, you know, since we're progressive types here, we'd want to ensure that the carbon tax, which on its face is regressive, right? Bill Gates paying it and me paying paying it, it takes a considerable bigger chunk of my income than it does bills, that's a problem, and we'd have to ensure that there were ways to mitigate that. Either the tax comes back to me as a rebate, or there are such things. In this REGI program we've gotten in the Northeast, the money that's generated from it for the states is funneled. It does not come back to taxpayers, and it does raise their rates from their utility or energy service company. It instead goes into their energy departments, or what we call NYSERDA here in New York, which uses it for various grant programs to energy efficiency, conservation, and renewable generation projects. So good stuff, but again, you've still got this fundamental problem of regressiveness.
A minute ago, you mentioned this is not a presidential executive order. This is a sort of encouragement of the EPA to issue rules. In other words, it's going through the agency, EPA. What would have stopped, I mean, what's stopping Obama from issuing an executive order as well as these EPA regulations? Wouldn't that have been stronger?
It would have been stronger. You could have arguments about the best tool to do this. I guess, Jack, what disturbs me more about going the rule-writing route than an executive order route is how long this has taken. Had the Obama administration been as serious as the president's rhetoric during his first campaign would have us believe, they would have had a rule or an order in their pocket as they walked in the door of the White House in January 2009. And that clearly was not the case. Instead, he foolishly thought he could get a cap and trade program through a Congress that, of course, listeners will recall, the Republican side of both those houses has seen their reason for being the destruction of the Obama presidency. So, rather than being realistic and operating under those conditions, he had this silly bipartisan fantasy that he could work with these folks.
Yeah, and six years later, it's still very clear that the Republicans aren't going to cooperate on any front whatsoever. So, it's perplexing to me why this guy, hasn't taken the executive order route on a whole number of different issues and directions, not just this this issue here of emissions and the environment. I mean, there should have been executive action taken quite some time ago on the housing problem and on the jobs problem and on tax avoidance by super wealthy folks. I mean, if he can't get anything through Congress, why hasn't he taken this route?
It's an excellent question, Jack. The irony of it is that his opponents in the Congress are constantly, and some of these complaints are legitimate, I will grant, but they're constantly complaining about the president as failing to uphold the law or breaking the law or illegal. The wackiest among them make noises every now and then about impeachment and the like. If that's what your opponents are claiming about you, then where's the risk in actually acting as a strong executive, right? He fails to do so.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you another question. I have a suspicion that all of this EPA emissions issue, which on its face appears very very positive, but as we know, and realistically, it's just going to be a talk shop for the next 2 years. It seems to me like this could also be a cover for signing the XL pipeline. I think that's coming right after the elections. I think the Democrats can't wait to sign the agreement to allow the XL pipeline, but now it looks like Obama is really pushing on emissions here, that sort of protects his credentials on the environment on the one hand, and then he goes and signs the XL pipeline on the other hand, and of course the environmentalists are going to be upset, but then he could say, well, we're doing something even more important here, and that has to do with the CO2 emissions. I'm really pro-environment. I don't know. I see this as a partial cover for actually moving quickly, in the case of the XL pipeline, right after your elections, where he dillies and dallies in the talk shop and all this response for more than 2 years on the industrial plant emissions. What's your opinion on that? Am I too Too suspicious?
No, I think that's a reasonable supposition. It is absolutely the case that the only thing that has kept the administration from approving it thus far, I predicted years ago that he'd say yay to XL. To the XL pipeline, delighted that my prediction is wrong. So what, how do we explain that? Well, the enormous and continued public opposition to it, including direct action along the route to the pipeline, and the massive coalition among both the big New York and D.C. environmental organizations, but also all sorts of environmental justice groups in the states through which the pipeline will pass. It's been that opposition which has stayed the president's hand, and I think you're right to say after congressional elections that he'll feel free to say okay to it. It's a, you know, it's a, it's it fits well. There are a couple of things going on here. One, it fits with his, and it's not just his, a history of presidential administrations giving with the one hand and taking away with the other. I think the Obama administration stands out in that regard, and I think the environmental field is an especially good case study of we'll give you that, you know, we'll let you have this one, we'll throw you a bone, but then we're going to throw industry a bone on another one. It's a back and forth and a seesaw that in the end, as historians, I think, will be come to a consensus that it's been a shameful environmental legacy for the president. The all of the above energy strategy that he likes to talk about. This includes fracking. This includes nuclear power. This includes more and more drilling for oil and gas, both onshore and offshore. This includes insufficient spending on conservation, efficiency, and renewables. It's, you know, not all that much different, Jack, the Obama energy policy from the George W. Bush energy policy.
Well, that's true not only with energy policy. That's true across the board, from what I can see after 6 years. Let's talk about this fracking. You know, obviously, fracking is... got the green light plus from the Obama administration. He's all for fracking. He's all for more natural gas production. And by the way, we got a glut of natural gas production in this country now because of this fracking. What are they going to do with this excess natural gas? Now it's even driving down the cost, and of course companies don't like that. They want to make more profits, and if the price is falling, they don't like that. So seems to me they're pushing hard against the limits on exporting natural gas. That would be a double positive for these energy companies because they could raise their profits by exporting and also create more of a shortage here in the U.S. and raise the price on the natural gas use in the U.S. And by the way, by extension, as I've talked about before, I think that has something to do tied in with Europe and the Ukraine and what's going on over there. The U.S. wants to break Germany and Western Europe from this growing economic relationship with Russia and dependency on their natural gas, and wants to sell them our natural gas. And I think that natural gas and energy policy has something to do with the politics going on the other side of the globe as well. But we have this issue of natural gas production and fracking and the total green light by the Obama administration. And then we have the XL pipeline. And then we have all of that's moving very quickly. And then we have all this dilly-dallying strategy and approach on the planet missions. So, you know, the approach you take says something about what your real priorities are, in my view.
Yeah, I think you're right, Jack. You know, about the cost of natural gas, it's the case that natural gas in the United States is the cheapest on the planet. And so, unsurprisingly, the producers would like to overturn the decades-long bans stemming from the oil shock of the 1970s on both gas and oil exports. It's currently here I'm talking about unrefined as opposed to finished products. It's currently against the law to do that. So they're the Obama administration's pretty pro LNG, which is the means by which you export the stuff. There's a process by which you take natural gas and turn it into liquefied natural gas that allows you to put the stuff on ships and move it across the globe. There currently very little of that going on at present, and yet many permit applications and a big battle going on right now on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, for example, that the Obama administration is in favor of. But at the same time, Jack, this is one of those classic sectoral squabbles among big capital. If you're a chemical company or a manufacturer in the U.S. at present, you love the low price of natural gas, and you thus also oppose the export of the stuff. So a couple of titans here, the producers up against some of the major industrial users. There is no agreement on exports.
Explain, you know, the tie-in here, natural gas has a tie-in to this issue with the EPA and coal-fired plants. Explain for our listeners the situation between new industrial plants, electricity-generating plants, and the existing plants that, you know, obviously produce all this the CO2. I mean, there are new rules, or are there new rules on new plants? And the new plants obviously would have to be natural gas economically versus these rules which apply to existing plants. Is that correct?
That's right. Just several months ago, the EPA came out with a new rule that covered new plants. So it felt like that was an easier lift than coming out, you know, that there would be opposition, of course, but it would be less, and they were right, than a rule that governed existing plants. And so the rule for new plants essentially made a coal-fired power plant a thing of the past. It again, without carbon storage and sequestration, a highly expensive, still mostly experimental technology by which you can strip carbon out of the flue as emissions are heading out of a carbon out of a coal-fired plant, and then do something with them, either bury them under the ground in some cavern or recycle them for an industrial process. It will be impossible to build a coal-fired plant and meet those new power plant regulations. The set we're talking about, though, today, you're right, Jack, are concern existing power plants. So yes, the conversion will be, because natural gas is so cheap, historically speaking, relatively speaking, at present, and that is due to fracking, that many of the new plants will be gas fired, and yet back to fracking now, and you know, is natural gas better than coal or oil? Well, on the one hand, yes, if you look at the emissions of all sorts of different gases, including carbon, and including various volatile organic compounds, and nitrates and oxides, gas is vastly superior to either oil or coal. And yet at the same time, we've found that the extraction process known as fracking has, in a number of places and in a number of cases, the Eagle Shale and the Ford Shale in Texas being the most notable, have resulted in methane releases at the wellhead. So here we're talking about the gas itself getting out. Methane is a vastly more polluting gas than carbon dioxide in terms of global warming potential. There's some controversy about exactly how much, but 25 times is a fair settlement of that controversy. If that's the case, Jack, if we're talking of even a few percentage of the gas being extracted via fracking leaking at the wellhead, that completely undoes the climate benefits of natural gas, and it is no longer superior to coal or oil in those terms. So when that's, and again, you know, does the industry want you to know this? No. Do they publish their own figures of these things? No. Since the EPA is instructed to be pro-fracking, we've heard very little little from them. Most of what we know about methane leaks at wellheads and the other gas infrastructure, the various pipelines and the like that moves the stuff, we know from university scientists and their in the past couple of few years, and their findings are very troubling.
Yes, especially in places like Texas. I understand, the problems are immense in terms of the destruction or pollution of the water table and the air pollution and diseases, cancer and everything people are getting down there in places like Fort Worth, where they're fracking everybody's backyard. Listeners should be aware that the new industrial plants will be almost all natural gas because of the economics, and now we're talking about forcing the old coal-fired plants to convert to natural gas as well. And is there a study or a source that people can go to at least see what is the trade-off in terms of CO2 converting these plants, old and new, to natural gas versus the contribution to CO2 and methane emissions from more fracking? Is there a source?
Oh, there are a whole bunch of them, Jack. Probably the easiest thing for me to do is send your listeners to the site, presuming they have computer access, of the Union of Concerned Scientists. A group that has collected a whole bunch of this stuff. It has its own scientific staff, and then also collates independent university research as well. So check out the Union of Concerned Scientists, and you'll find all sorts of good stuff. Yeah, Jack, earlier in my critique of fracking, that was just on the problem of methane leaks in the production process itself. There then is, as you say, a slew of very serious problems with fracking. Natural gas is not, as the industry or as the Obama administration claims, the, quote, bridge fuel to the future, unquote. What we need is a carbon-free or sometimes even carbon-negative society, one that relies wholly on improved efficiency, doing more with less, that old-fashioned notion of conservation, and then various clean, green generation technologies. All of these technologies are off the shelf. They exist. We know how to do them. They're more cost-effective. They create better, longer-lasting jobs. There are vast improvements to public and environmental health. It's a complete and total no-brainer from a scientific or humanistic perspective. It's just, of course, that we happen to find ourselves in a political economy where those with the deepest stakes in the status quo are able to control the process.
Comment on the following. There was a strange thing in the last few weeks in California, the other big natural gas, shale gas source. It was called the Marcellus Shale here in Central California. Huge. I think some say as big as the other two major sources of shale gas, which is in the Dakotas and in Texas. And they had estimated the Marcellus Shale was even bigger than North Dakota's source. But then all of a sudden this report comes out and says, oh, they overestimated it by 96%. The Marcellus Shale supply is really only a pittance of what it was first estimated. How can we trust any of these estimates coming out of government and business? What's your comment on this 96% reduction on their initial estimate of the size of the Marcellus Shale?
Yeah, I saw that too, Jack. I think you're referring to the Monterey Shale in California.
Oh, yes, excuse me, Monterey. Marcellus is in the east. I'm sorry. Monterey
Shale. Marcellus
is
here in the northeast, beneath West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and New York, being heavily worked in both West, also a little bit in Ohio, heavily worked in West Virginia and Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is really the epicenter of fracking in the northeast. But we've got a moratorium here in New York State, and so thus far, and the politics for Governor Cuomo are very similar sort of the politics for President Obama that we were talking about for the Keystone XL pipeline. He is afraid of the environmentalists who generally support him, and he thus far has not given the green light. But to this question of estimates and numbers, you're quite right. One ought not to believe in any of these estimates, especially the bigger they are, the more skeptical one ought to be. And that's not just of industry's estimates, but also of the U.S. Geological Survey, which is has produced numbers for each and every one of the shale formations, from the Bakken in North Dakota to the Marcellus here in the Northeast to the Eagle Ford and others in Texas and elsewhere. These numbers inevitably prove wrong, are reduced significantly, and this also points up to the economics of the business, Jack. I think fracking has certainly here in the Northeast, perhaps in Texas, maybe less so in California because it's less advanced, has already peaked, that the smart money has already gotten out, that many leases have been sold, that many of the original companies that blazed these trails in shale formations with tight oil and gas have already moved on to other things. So if you look at the investment politics of it, in some ways it's already peaked and is on a downward spiral. But it's a fantasy to think that we can become energy independent in terms of fossil fuels. We're not, even with the vast amounts of oil that are being prized from North Dakota shale formations via fracking, and then that come because there's still no pipelines are coming via oil trains through much of the United States, including very close to where I am here in Albany, where much of the stuff is transshipped off of oil tankers, locomotive tankers, to ships that then go down to the Hudson and down to Philadelphia and up to Nova Scotia to oil refineries. That is but a fraction of what the United States consumes on a daily basis. So it's an absolute pipe dream to think we can drill our way to energy independence. The only way we get to anything approximating energy independence ever, let alone prior to climate calamity, is by transitioning as quickly as possible away from those same fuel sources and technologies.
Yes, and listeners should be aware that when we talk about energy independence and so forth, the U.S. is number one, or at least if not number one, number two export is oil and chemicals. We are exporting oil. You know, I mean, if we really want to be energy independent, well, let's just prevent the exportation, put some tariffs on the exportation of oil and the processed oil, which we call chemicals. That's our number one export. So all this production is really for export and thus for profits for the oil companies and energy companies. That's just a comment. People should keep that in mind. But in what we got left, I want to turn back to these industrial plant rules, the EPA regulations, proposals here for regulations and so forth. We've sort of discussed its major outlines of, 30% benchmark reduction, and it's going to be up to the states. Some states will have a target 11%, some will have as high as 72%, and all those issues that flow from that. But some say that I'm reading that, these rules are really pretty complex. Other than this general 30% target, what do they mean by that? What are the other elements of this proposal by the EPA?
Yeah, there are a bunch of details, Jack. I think they're I don't know how wonky the audience is. My sense is they're probably less important than some of the broad outlines. So one thing I would quickly say is that already the critics have complained that the draft rule is going to drive up electricity costs, and yet the EPA's response is that due to the rule, there will be greater spending on energy efficiency across the power sector, and thus we're likely to have lower electricity bills when it's fully implemented come 2030. It's these kind of broader points, I think, that are most useful. But the single most important one, and you maybe some listeners have been confused because of the diversity of statements they're hearing from environmental groups they may be members of or followers of, is that the big ones, the big 10 or 12 that are based in New York and Washington, have, with no exceptions, slapped the president on the back for this. They think this is overdue, one, but also urgently needed and the best we can do. But if you look on, you know, just the sort of the next circle of organizations, there's greater clarity and I think truth-telling around the fact that this is but a drop in the bucket. This is not going to, on its own, lower greenhouse gas pollution enough to prevent catastrophic effects of climate change. We need a whole bunch of other steps that don't appear on the horizon to get us there. So, you know, good step, not enough, needs to be quickly followed up with the kind of rhetoric we heard some years ago regarding a Manhattan Project or an Apollo program by the way of a transition from a 19th or 20th century energy system to one that's going to save us from disaster in the 21st century. And I'm sorry to say, Jack, there's not in this country or most anywhere else a very high prospect for that.
But what are some of these second-tier groups that are more critical of this that listeners may be able to approach and find some more realistic facts about these proposals?
Yeah, one that comes immediately to mind, Jack, is the Rainforest Action Network. It took them a few days. I'm sure there were kind of intense debates. People who have worked for these groups know that messaging around this kind of stuff is tricky, and you've got to be careful not to cut off access and alienate constituents and the like. But I think it was just today that Rainforest Action Network came out with an announcement that essentially echoes what I've been telling you this afternoon, which is that this is not enough and needs to be quickly bolstered. Another group that has said that has been one of the leaders in the anti-fracking movement, which is Food and Water Watch. And then I think those are two that come to mind immediately. And I think in coming days, there'll be more of this kind of, you know, cautious, critical response and less of the excitement around the big groups that followed the announcement immediately, which was, you know, Yahoo and Yippee and send an email thanking the EPA for this or tell the president he's great as a consequence. Again, yes, this is better than nothing, but at the same time is nowhere near what is necessary. And if it is not followed up with policies, executive orders or executive action that gets us to making very serious reductions in greenhouse emissions. We're talking about 6 to 10%, Jack, just in the next decade or two to forestall disaster. If it's not followed up by that, then, you know, one could even make the argument that this is worse than nothing. And let me follow up quickly too, because you started the program with I think an important insight regarding remoteness of problems, and that for many of us, that unless a problem is right in our face, we either don't want to deal with it or don't know how to deal with it. I think that was a fair description of the problem of climate change for the last couple of decades. I no longer think it's a fair description. The evidence for serious, ongoing, accelerating climate change in all of our listeners' sensory range is clear and overwhelming. To claim now that there, as the deniers do, that there isn't scientific consensus or there is not sufficient perceptual evidence is really just self-deception and getting in the way of the actions we need to take.
Well, my comment on that was not to downplay the reality of global warming and climate change, which is true, but simply to point out with this particular issue, it's not like you lose your job, but you got no income. That's obvious, you know. Or even the water tastes bad, it's poisonous, right? Or even you look down the street and it's, you know, if you're in Beijing, China or something, people walking around with face masks because the pollution is so bad. And having been there, I can attest to that. That's the most polluted place in the world. I mean, it's hard for people to see climate change. Yes, they can see weather, but the climate change itself is a hard thing to see as the imminent threat, the major threat that it really is. And that's part of the politics of this thing that makes it so difficult and makes it easy for deniers then to come in and throw in all their ideology and all their negative falsifications about the problem. But
Jack, tens of millions of Americans have been affected, some severely, by extreme weather that's very clearly linked to climate change. All the climate models have for the last couple of decades been predicting more intense and or more frequent extreme weather events, whether it's tornadoes or thunderstorms or hurricanes or tidal increases, you name it. And so, you know, out there in the West, you guys don't get hurricanes as much as we do here on the East and Gulf Coast. But again, tens of millions already affected by extreme weather events directly attributable to climate change. So, you know, that's very clear. And then, you know, the other thing to say about deniers, it's an industry, right? The Koch brothers, the oil companies, the Heartland Institute have a multi-million dollar, decades-long effort to muddy up the science, very similar to the way the tobacco companies did regarding cigarette science. And they are, I think, less and less effective. More and more of us can see through them. And yet, as we also averred earlier in the program, some key anti-science and climate change denier types are in positions of power in the U.S. Congress and elsewhere.
Oh, yes, there's no doubt about that. You know, scientifically, factually, the facts are overwhelming that this is a serious problem. But it just seems to me if you want to create an effective movement, you can't rely on facts and science alone. That there are emotional elements to a movement and feelings and so forth, and a good, an effective movement is able to capture those emotions and those feelings and have themes that are emotional as well as themes that are factual. And it seems sometimes that environmentalists argue the facts rather than the emotions. As a former union organizer for years myself, I can tell you, you can talk facts till you're blue in the face, but usually when you lose an election for a union, it's because the employer resorted to fear or resorted to promises about security and so forth that were not factual at all. So politically winning is about having an emotional strategy as well as a factual strategy, you might say. And one of my critiques of the environmental movement would be that at least certain sections of it rely too much on factual arguments and not enough on emotional appeals.
Yes.
But that,
I think you're right, Jack.
You need to link up some of these horror stories from hurricanes and so forth more with the movement and the threat. But then, of course, you only have hurricanes in certain parts of the country, right? And in some parts of the country, global warming, climate change means that there's going to be a cooling because you'll have more rain. So it's a difficult issue to organize around, but, you know, in as we conclude this discussion, I hear the music coming on, you know, I would just tell listeners, don't believe the government when they tell you about these new rules, EPA and so forth. For me, maybe I'm too suspicious. It seems like another political maneuver on their part. They know nothing's going to happen before 2016, because of the way they are approaching this question. On the face, it sounds like a great move by the EPA, but they know damn well nothing's going to happen. And if they really wanted something to happen, they would have issued an executive order behind it. And, of course, they haven't done that. And really, you could argue this is really about the industry, energy industry, giving them incentives to convert from one fossil fuel to another fossil fuel, and the net result may be even worse CO2 emissions and other emissions, not a solution to it. And as you pointed out, the solution is alternative energy. You know, sun and wind and solar and wind and so forth. That's what we should be talking about. That's what executive orders should be being issued on right now. That's what the EPA should be talking about. But that's not in this mix, is it? Okay, well, we hear the music here. Steve, I'd like to thank you so much for this very informed, certainly when it comes to the EPA and these rules, you're the go-to person here, and perhaps we'll have you back on when this thing heats up a little bit further later on down the road to talk about the EPA and these new rules. But folks, dig into this. Don't think this is the answer. Look into the details of this and the detailed politics as well as the science of this, and get down to the real truth behind these EPA emissions rules. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. We'll be talking to you next week.